Hi, and welcome to the Small Business Breakdown. I'm Emily Ashby.
I'm Bryce Hansen.
And I'm Paul Wolford.
And we are business advisors helping you break down the ins and outs of running your business. Our how-to podcast series will provide insights, education, and takeaways to help you increase revenue and have some fun along the way, because
the more you know, the more you grow.
Hey, welcome to today's podcast, How to Create Projections and Estimate Cash Flow Needs. And we have back with us from last episode our guest, Chris Heslop. Welcome back.
Good to have you, Chris.
Glad to be here.
And just a reminder, he's one of the advisors for the Salt Lake Small Business Development Center. He's going to cover three main ideas today with us. First, what are the leading indicators that drive results? Second, what are the key indicators and assumptions or metrics when creating your cash flow projection? And third, what are the tools that we can use to help us to do this? Now, Emily Ashby, our fearless co-host, is not with us today, but she's out gallivanting on a vacation, having fun. We'll miss her, but we're going to go forward now. Chris, thanks for being with us again. Help us understand leading indicators.
So leading indicators are the things that actually drive the results you're after. You know, so often people will sit there and it's like, you need to create a dashboard. And so they put on revenue and they put on, net, what's my gross margin? What's my net profit? Those are important things and we need to track those. But it's a little late. If it's not in revenue, it's not going to come. At the end of the quarter, if it didn't hit revenue, it's not hitting revenue. So what we want to do is we want to identify what are those things that produce the customers that then become revenue. And so it's a very much, I had one client and they did parts for aircraft maintenance. It was a really bad thing when two airplanes would crash into each other. And so that was one of their products that they sold. Their place to find their customers was at the trade shows. They did three trade shows a year, one in the US, two others outside. And that was where they would get their customers. If they didn't do the trade shows, the people didn't necessarily remember them. For other companies, it may be going out and calling on commercial realtors is one I did. Maybe realtors, if you do mortgage brokering, things like that, you want to be talking to the people who generate the mortgages, which is not the individual buyer. It's the realtor who's selling that individual buyer, earlier you and I were talking about that story, and this is like a 40-year-old story that has remained very popular with the readers of this one magazine. It's called Strike the Steel.
Yes. I like that. This is a great story.
It's a wonderful story. And I'm probably going to, change it a little bit just because it's been 40 years since I actually really, really read it. But
is it like one of those things like over time when you go on a hunt, it's a bigger antler or a bigger fish when you go
fishing over time. So it gets, the story is of a kid, this is in most people don't remember the 80s when prime was 23%, and inflation and all that stuff. But so this kid graduates from high school. He's trying to save for an LDS mission. And he gets a job, and his job is to knock the concrete off of the steel parking bollards. So these are the bars that go into the ground so that you don't drive off of the pavement and things like that, don't drive into the building. So his job is to knock it off. And so he is—
Knock the concrete off.
Okay. Yes, thank you. So he is there, and he's working, and he's sledging the hammer, and, he's hitting the sledgehammer and nothing's happening. And it's another day. And he's like, I'm going to lose this job. I really need this job. Back then jobs were incredibly hard to find. And he's just positive he's going to lose this job. So he's at lunch one day and he's eating and the thought keeps coming to him, strike the steel. And he's like, that is the dumbest thing I have ever thought of. That is so stupid. But it keeps coming to him. And finally, he's like, well, what have I got to lose? I'm going to lose the job. I might as well try it. So after lunch, he starts striking the steel. And at first, nothing happens. And then all of a sudden, the concrete just falls off. And I don't mean pieces fall off. I mean the whole, we're talking the 18, 24 inches of concrete just comes off of the steel. Wow. So by the end of the shift, he has done all of these poles that he's supposed to get it off. Now, his foreman that he, you know, reports to, he's this crusty, profane guy, every other word's, you know, a swear word kind of type. And they come down off of the high rise, down the elevators, and the crew walks out and they see the steel poles without any concrete. They see the concrete over to the side and their jaws all pretty much drop to the ground. And they're like, show up tomorrow. I don't know what you're going to do, but show up tomorrow. You know, and so, you know, I read that when I was, you know, we won't even go into how old I was. And so a few years later I'm working and it's like, okay, well, wait, you know, that's a really good story. And I think it applies in business. And so at that time I was a banker. I sold money. It's a lousy business. You know, you have to pay more than a dollar to get the dollar to lend out for a dollar. and so I start calling on commercial realtors. Now, all of a sudden, I'm getting 6, 7, 8 deals a year from these commercial realtors. I'm doing like 5 and 10 times as much as my coworkers are doing because I'm striking the steel. Who is it that knows? And by the way, it's not just that I get the commercial mortgage for them. I'm giving them the line of credit, their equipment loan. The realtors are coming to me and going, hey, wait, you can't do 100% financing. This guy, he's buying a $2 million building and you gave him $3 million in financing. You can't do 100% financing, I thought. I'm not doing 100% financing. We got him an SBA loan for 90%. But, you know, when you move, you know, the accounts receivable, they get delayed. You know, you need new equipment. It's a bigger place. So we gave him, you know, $500,000 for his accounts receivable. We gave him, you know, $500,000 for his equipment so he can buy new equipment. All of a sudden, we're doing some really great deals. We're getting these customers. So in the same way, we want to be able to find where is the steel for our business? What is it that allows us to find out where the people are who are in motion? You know, if...
I like that. To find out where the people are that are already in motion.
Correct.
That's great. I love that quote.
You know, at least I have, been asked by some salesmen, so, you know, who do you know that I should be talking to? You know, who do you know that needs a new car? Who do you know that needs, you know, insurance? And those are the ones you usually get asked. And your mind goes blank because I know a lot of people, but I'm not sure who needs a new car. Whereas if you take and go, okay, who do you know that just had a child? Who do you know who just had a kid leave for college? Who do you know who had someone just get married or something, you know? Now all of a sudden, you've defined it for the people also. And why do I say those kinds of things? Because that's when people are in motion. That's when they make a lot of differences. That's when you can get them to make a change. You know, whether this fits in the podcast, I don't know, but...
I think it's great. No, this is awesome. So then that applies to making, you know, a projection, a financial projection. You're saying, hey, look, the key indicators, right? What's striking the steel here as you're building this out that's predictive of then what's going to be successful is what I'm getting from that.
Yeah. You know, so we want to find out, you know, where do we go? Who do we talk to? Yeah, there's a story, and I think it's actually in the book we talked about last time, Guerrilla Marketing. A guy noticed that, you know, hey, a bunch of my customers drive Porsches. So what does he do? He gets the list of the Porsche Owners Club. Business like quintuples because all of a sudden he's now found where, you know, when you fill out those forms, you know, what do you like to do? What's your hobbies? The reason they're doing that is they're trying to figure out where do I go to find you and others like you.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we start thinking about that, you know, I had one client I was working with at the SBDC, and he was doing gift boxes, and they were for people of a certain you know, cultural ancestry. And he's like, "Well, there's this magazine, you know, but they're just so expensive to advertise in." And I'm like, "Well, do they have a Facebook page?" And he's like, "Well, yeah, of course they do." I said, "Well, you know, you can advertise to the followers of that Facebook page." What? You can pick who you're advertising to, and you can say, I want to advertise to followers of this page. And then you can pay Facebook ad rates instead of the $3,000 and $5,000 ad rates mm-hmm. that the magazine is going to charge you.
And people will actually see it.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. And it, he left and it was like, wait, I think this is even better than advertising in the magazine. So, you know, there's a lot of different things we can do there.
So let me just jump in. So as you're kind of, when I look at the striking the steel, like what's going to make the biggest difference? You know, when I build a projection template with my own clients, a lot of times, you know, we'll go towards, we'll create a revenue model tab.
Sure.
And the way I look at what with this leading the indicators, there's usually something like, okay, you're saying that you can get $5,000 a month or 10 or 20 or 50,000 a month, but what are those drivers that drive that that then will allow you to get that money? And so what is striking the steel there? It's the very core, like going backwards, like working backwards into what is the very one thing that you do that you can control at the first of the month that then drive the sales for the rest of the month. And that's kind of striking the steel we're trying to get to in this case.
Yes.
And you mentioned earlier, I think, we could have a lot of stories, but there's in one, I think we talked about it earlier today. I'm trying to remember.
Was it the hotel or was it the sporting goods store shooting range?
I think it might have been the shooting range. Right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Because we can take in either one of those.
Yeah.
You know, so well, just taking and pausing for a second on yeah. that. You know, both you and I have had so many people who come to, oh, we can get 10% of this market.
Sure. Right.
Oh yeah. This is a $2 billion market, and we're going to get 10% in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I will look at that and I go, okay, well, what I really don't care about the 10% of this market. I want to know how you're going to get your first 5, your first 100, your first 250. Help me understand that. Now, going back to some of those metrics. So I was working with a client of the SBDC, brilliant doctor. He was retired. He had just done amazing things with his practice as far as taking and more, so essentially he grew his business by 500% while the price per product went down 80%. So that's like a 25X increase in revenue that he did, or I should say 25X increase in business. And he did it with the same number of staff. So he wanted to start a sporting goods shooting range type of business. And he's trying to figure out how much of each product he's going to sell. And, you know, Bryce, you and I have had clients who think that's the way that you do it. And we don't know what's going to sell in the future. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to guess what's going to sell now. You know, I've had the same thing with restaurants. You know, one guy was trying to figure out how many pounds of butter he was going to need in the 37th month. And I'm like, you know, if they come out and say baked potatoes are bad for you, the butter projection is all wrong now. You know, so, but we can say, okay, here's what I do know. And so in taking the restaurant, it would be, okay, my average plate, my average meal is going to be, and let's say $15. And mm-hmm. my food cost will be 30-something percent. And my labor cost will be, you know, 20% or something. And so we can work with that. You know, in the story of the sporting goods store, like I said, he's trying to figure out how many he's going to sell of each product each month. We don't know, and it doesn't really matter. And that's where that's where you get the migraines. You know, I had a client once with a hotel who was trying to figure out which rooms each night of the month would rent.
Oh my gosh.
For a 5-year projection. You know, that's like 1,000 decision points a month
that's
for her.
That's brutal just to.
Oh, she had a migraine. I thought I'd have a migraine too if I were you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, going back to the sporting goods store, so I said, so do you know what your average ticket is going to be? Now, this one really surprised me because he'd had a study done, but when I said yes, he goes, yeah, it's, and I don't remember the exact amount, but it's $69.86. And I'm like, 86 cents? Oh, yeah, he had a professional feasibility study done. Okay. So, by the way, do you know how much of your sales are on the weekend versus the weekday? And so we started with a few basic questions. We were then able not only to figure out, okay, here's your projection on your revenue and figure that out for a year in less than an hour, because we had the key numbers. How much revenue, how much per transaction? Just divide one by the other, and you get the number of transactions. Oh, and we now know, okay, 60% of the business is on the weekend, 40% of it is on the weekdays.
So you can project the revenue by almost the day, and generically the day,
yes.
Yeah.
And then we could also say, okay, now how much staff do I need to have on hand? Mm-hmm. Now, he had to check people in and out. Now, the interesting thing there was he was thinking that he could handle, and I don't remember now what the number was, but it was like 30 people an hour with one person. Oh, and wow. I'm like, well, how long does it take to check them in and out? He goes, 10 minutes. And I'm like, well, I don't think you can do one person checking in 30 people
that
in 1 hour.
Doesn't quite work out.
Yeah. But when you take and ask some of those questions, now all of a sudden it's like, oh, hey, I can figure out how much staffing I need, or I can figure out, oh, my cost of goods sold is going to average 50%. So I know what my revenue is. I now know what my cost of goods sold will be. The hotel. What's my average daily rate? What's my percentage of occupancy? How many rooms do I have? Three key numbers. And now you've got something you can work with. And then, you know, looking at like a restaurant, okay, I'm doing my lunch analysis. I'm looking at my lunch trade. You know, I have 50 people who come in for lunch, and the average is $12.50. Okay, well, I want to increase that. Most of the time, if you ask a restaurateur, well, how would you get 6 more people in? Oh, I know exactly how to do that. Now, if you ask him, how are you going to increase your revenue by $5,000 a month? He's going to look at you like, well, wait, what? No, we want to break it into what are those metrics? And as you were saying earlier, it's like, okay, if I know that for every 10 prospects I contact, I'm going to end up with 2 appointments. And for every 2 appointments I have, my conversion rate is 50%. Maybe it's really 60%. I'm going to say 50. So now I know if I'm calling on 2 people per day that are new and I have a 50% conversion rate, well, then I'm probably going to end up with 5 new customers per week. And so I can start working with those kind of numbers. You know, now, I would caution, usually for people to do this, it really does help for them to come in and talk to someone at the SBDC, because it helps to have someone kind of go, well, hey, what about this? What about that? And then it helps bring it into focus a lot faster than if you're trying to do it on your own. And of course, at the SBDC, we've got a team of people who've worked with hundreds of businesses that allow you to be able to draw on their experience. Oh, we had a client who did this, and this closely applies, or it is the same.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is great. And yeah, absolutely reach out to the SBDC in your area. And by the way, the SBDC's, you know, if you're listening to this nationally, somehow found our podcast. We're based in Utah. We have a Utah SBDC network, but these SBDC networks are located throughout the country. There's about 63 of them in total. Every state has at least one.
Not just the states. So, you know, if you're in Puerto Rico, you're
sure.
in Guam.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yep. Yeah. Don't forget them.
Yep. So great, great resources. So we encourage you to reach out to your local SBDC there. So, Chris, we just talked about leading indicators. And now let's talk about, you know, other assumptions and metrics we look at, such as, you know, direct versus indirect costs, you know, looking to keep your overhead low, other things along those lines.
So, you know, one of the things that gets a lot of people confused, you know, it seems like CPAs, bankers, business people, we have all these different terms that really mean the same thing. And I've actually been in conversations where I would have to go through 5 different terms before I found the one that the person I was talking to could understand what I meant. And by the way, that was a banker to banker, and we still went through that. So indirect and direct cost, contribution to margin or contribution to profit. I like the one contribution to profit. So one of the first things we want to understand is, for the average transaction, what is it that costs me to do that business? Now, if I'm in a service business, my labor is a cost of sales. And too often people don't realize that and that. But so if I'm in a service business and a $100 transaction cost me $50 in labor cost, then that means that the other $50 goes to cover my overhead. Now, what's another term for that? Okay, that would be my direct cost is $50 and my indirect cost is my overhead. And my contribution to cover my indirect cost is that other 50 cents or 50%. And now when we start thinking about that, oh my, and I like using round numbers because I don't think that well on my feet. So, you know, if my overhead is $10,000 a month and I have a 50% direct cost, and I do.
And again, direct cost is going to be typically it's like the cost of good, like the cost that you put, the cost for you to make or to buy your inventory you then resell.
Correct.
Or the cost of providing the service.
Yeah, or cost of buying the service. Or
providing it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And so, and then direct cost technically could also be the direct sales cost that you pay someone to sell it. Potentially.
I love that you said that because so many people don't count that, and really you should.
Yeah.
Because if you don't make that sell, that other none of those other costs, and that's part of it, is it's the incremental or marginal cost. If I don't sell this, I don't have these costs. If I don't sell that $100 item, I don't have to buy the spend the $50 for the item, and I don't have to pay the 5% sales commission or whatever it is. And so you get that, and then all of a sudden it becomes very easy because now it's like, oh, for every $100 I sell, I make $50 to cover my overhead, often referred to as indirect cost. And my overhead, like we said in this example, is $10,000. So if I do $20,000.
And by the way, let me just interject.
Sure.
Sometimes people refer to those in some cases as fixed costs.
Exactly.
In a lot of ways. Like your fixed cost, fixed overhead, and overhead. Kind of synonymous.
So many terms that mean the same thing,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so when you sit there and it feels like an alphabet soup, there's a reason why, because we do use a lot of different terms to refer to the same thing. Mm. It's funny because, in the Goldman Sachs program, they do a week of training in the 10,000 Small Business program because they, even if you understand finances, you don't speak the same language. So we need to make sure we're speaking the same language as we go through it. So, yeah. So if I'm doing $20,000 and I have a 50% margin, which is another way of saying 50% contribution to profit, and my overhead or fixed cost is $10,000, I did 20, half of that is 10, I didn't make any profit, but I did break even, But then again, I also know if I do $22,000, I made $1,000. I do $30,000, I made $5,000. Mm. I remember working with a hotel operator once, and this is the same one who was trying to figure out which room is going to rent. And then we went through that. And one of the questions said, so how much does it cost you to turn a room? Now, so for her, her cost, the direct cost was the cost of turning the room, having the maid go in and clean it, the toiletries and things like that. And she goes, Chris, I don't know. How do I figure that out? So we figured it out, worked it up. And it was actually really, it was like $13 a night or something. And that was if she sent in the maid to clean and all that. And so we're going through this stuff and she's like, wait, Chris, I turned away. They're building a new school here. And the contractors come in on Monday. She was in a destination resort where they could come in on Friday and leave, Sunday night, Monday morning. She goes, they're building a new school. The contractor's coming in. They come in on Monday and they leave Friday morning. Now, my competition doesn't have any phones or TVs. Talk about rustic. And this was in the 2000s. and she goes, and I turned them away because, they're only charging them like $50 a night. You mean, and by the way, the contractors didn't care if she sent in the maids during the week, so she only had to do one maid. We figured it was like $20 for the week for her to turn the room. She goes, you mean if I were to rent these for $50 a night, $200 a week, I'm clearing $175.
Wow. Hmm.
I'm like, yes, you got it. You absolutely got it. Guess whose place was full for the next 6 months with the contractors building that school? helped her come out of a big hole.
Wow.
And
nice.
And so, you know, when we look at it that way, it's like, okay, well, sometimes it does make sense to break price. Because, you know, there is nothing more perishable than an airplane seat, a hotel bed.
I did come up with
a third one, but I forgot what it is now. You know, I remember one time going to the airport, you know, 10 minutes before the earlier flight leaves, and they wanted to charge me for it to switch flights. And I just looked at the guy and I go, if you charge me for it, I'm going to miss the flight. Are you really going to sell another seat on either of these flights in the next hour? Here's your boarding pass. Get on.
This is good, though. This, I think, an important thing to understand from looking at this is, I mean, oftentimes we make very emotional decisions in business, and it's hard to, you know, if you're doing the right thing even, and you're just kind of go on your gut. And that's a really bad way to run business. You always make mistakes. You're probably half the time you're making a mistake when you think you're doing something right. So if you have these key indicators and these metrics set up properly, it's really easy to make decisions. You don't have to stress about it.
Yeah, and they're easy to remember usually, incredibly easy to remember, and easy to explain. You know, the other thing, and I think we've talked before, it's been a while, Bryce, but, you know, too often on the other side, people break price when they shouldn't.
Oh.
And usually that's because they really don't understand what their costs are.
Huh. That's a good point.
You know, I had one client once, and we were going over their chart of accounts and their financials. And as I'm going over it, they have all kinds of production costs not under cost of goods sold. And so as I'm going over this, it's like, wait a second. You have 30% cost that are not being captured as cost of goods sold. Now, she fought me on it. And I'm like, well, wait, you told me that these supplies here were used in producing your product. You know, they did silk screening and stuff like that on shirts and that. And I said, and you told me that this is used in doing your production. And you told me that. So she's like, oh, I guess you're right. And then she just gets this horrified look on her face. And I'm like, what's the matter? And she goes, we routinely give a 35% discount.
Oh, wow. Just giving product away for free.
Yeah.
And that was her profit margin.
Oh,
that
was my God.
That was it. And she was wondering why she couldn't pay the rent.
Wow. So, Chris, this is great. I mean, it's very apparent that you know, we're lucky to have Chris with us at the SBDC in the Salt Lake this time. You know, a lot of people, I mean, the insight that you bring to your clients is amazing. And I think a lot of people benefited from your service and your work. So kudos to you. Thanks for being here again. And really important, one thing, you know, as far as metrics go, there's certain things like a lot of people who come to us ultimately in some way, they need to get resources and maybe they're trying, the reason they're putting together a financial projection is to get a loan.
Yes.
And so, you know, a lot of tools out there for entrepreneurs is overkill for most small businesses. And financial projections don't have to be super, super fancy. They have to get to the point and really be a workable tool. But then there's also metrics to really look at and say, okay, what are those core things that really like a bank typically would want to have? And so we could put those into the financial projection. And you mentioned one earlier offline, we're talking. Can you go ahead and kind of cover that? Like the very like core, like not all the bells and whistles, but like the core things that a banker or a bank's going to say, hey, you got to know this, right?
Yeah. Well, the bank doesn't actually say that you need to know it, but it's the first one of the first things they're looking at.
Yeah.
So yeah. So and that was a topic about you know what I often refer to as funds available to service debt. You know, everyone hears about EBITDA. Well, EBITDA does not pay back a loan. EBITDA does not necessarily mean that you get to take it home as profit. But funds available to service debt is a very real number, and so bankers will look at that, you know, and like I said, I typically focused on deals for companies saying, you know, 10 or 20 million a year or under in revenue. And so the equation that we would often look at, well, we always looked at, is, okay, what's net income after taxes? Now, by the way, if you have a bunch of non-deductible expenses, we would take that into account, but most people don't. You know, so net income after taxes, and then the first things we add back in are depreciation, if they have amortization, and then interest. Well, why? Well, because you don't write a check. I've never seen anyone write a check to depreciation or amortization. I've never met him yet. And interest is what you use to pay in the loan payment. So when we do that calculation, that gives us a pretty good feel of here is the amount of money this business generated in this period, whether it's a year or a quarter, that can actually be used to repay the loan. And then you calculate, well, what is the debt service? What is the payment that is required to service this loan?
And that's the total payments for that period. So if it's a year, it's the 12 payments.
Correct.
Of loan payment that you're paying on.
Of the existing debt plus the proposed debt.
Okay. Yep.
Now another thing, some lenders, if they're not careful, they may forget, especially like if you're doing a building, you know, hey, I can add back the rent expense. You know, I was talking to a client this morning, and she goes, you know, I used to have a bunch of coaches. And by the way, she had a lot of coaches, like $50,000 a year in coaching. And so, you know, how's that working for you? Oh, I don't use them anymore. How's that going to impact my loan ability? And I said, you know, something like that, that's a really easy thing for you to explain to a lender and say, you know, I did this, and I found that I was no longer getting the return on it. And so I have stopped that, and that expense is gone. And that's a very easy, you know, that makes sense. Now, when you sit here and say, well, you know, I'm not going to be buying that product anymore. Well, you still have to sell a product, so you're still going to have a cost of goods sold. But for that one, that's a good one. And like I said, so, you know, if I'm refinancing debt, I would take and net that for what the new payment is. The one thing, different lenders look at line of credits a little bit differently. Some of them will say it's only the interest that I'm looking at. Some of them may say, well, if something goes wrong, can they repay it in 5 years? And so you can ask a lender how they do it. You know, an amortization tables, if you don't know how to do one, come see us at the SBDC. It's really easy to do that for all of us and that. So those are one of the things that the lenders first look at. Yeah. And then they kind of look at, okay, well, if something goes wrong, what's a secondary source of repayment? And ideally, it's not liquidating the business. Lenders really don't like to liquidate businesses. It's not fun for anyone.
They don't want to own the business.
Oh, yeah. You know.
What do they do with all the assets once they have them?
And if you're buying something from the bank, you want a deal.
Yeah.
Oh, can I get this for 5 cents on the dollar? You want 10 cents on the dollar? Oh, crap. You're overpriced. No. So, yeah. You know, and during the Great Recession, I had conversations many times with borrowers saying, look, as long as you can keep the lender confident that you can do a better job than they can, they're going to help. They're going to be leaning towards having you work through this, you know, unless the regulators start pushing them or something like that. But usually if you can show the regulators, hey, look, it's better to have him run this than for us to take it back, the regulators are probably going to agree. And especially during COVID, you know, this is not like last time where they would be out on the press saying, oh, you know, the lenders need to do this. And then they would come into the lenders and be like the ruler on the side, whacking fingers. Mm. What do you mean you did that? I never went to parochial school, but I heard about it.
So you're saying today in the time of COVID that the regulators are less stringent. They're kind of,
They're more realistic.
They're more realistic this time around.
Whereas typically they tend to be like a pendulum.
Yeah.
You know, when they should be trying to make things a little easier, they're saying you need to tighten up. Mm. You know, and that's a personal belief of mine. You know, they make a lot of exceptions when things are good, and then they don't want to make any exceptions when things get tight. Well, that's probably when you need to make a few more.
Yeah, maybe maybe on the other side. You're right. Yep. So, well, great. So, so those are some of the kind of that's a metric side of things, right? We talked about leading indicators and some of the metrics that we need to have in there and be cognizant of from the with creating the projections.
Yeah.
And so third, tools. You know, can we talk about the tools that people use that you've seen other people use to actually do these projections?
You know, there's a lot of different resources available. You know, most businesses use QuickBooks. You could actually do budgets in QuickBooks. What is a budget? It's a projection. You know, so there's a way you could do that. And the nice thing about the QuickBooks projections is you can then track them. You know, and if you're building them based on those metrics we talked about and those key indicators, you know, so many clients per month, et cetera, then it's very easy to kind of monitor and measure that. There's other resources. Excel is incredibly powerful. You can build a lot in Excel. You know, but make sure, you know, make sure you're talking to someone who can help guide you through the process. You know, when you come in and you present a financial projection and it shows as an operating expense buying a bunch of equipment, it doesn't help the funder. So that could be a venture capitalist or a banker or whoever, feel really comfortable that you understand finances, because when you buy a piece of equipment, it is not an operating expense. It's a balance sheet item. You're building the balance sheet. You're converting cash or maybe a loan into that piece of equipment.
And that's not revenue. People get that mixed up.
Correct.
It's not revenue.
Yeah. Correct. You know, it's interesting. In the last week, I had two different financial projections. Well, no, financial results that I was looking at. And one had taken and decreased his revenue by the amount that he had invested in the company.
Hmm.
Well, an investment is not revenue. That goes on the balance sheet. And maybe this may be getting a little more technical than we want to, but then the next guy I look at, he has included the investment as revenue. Now, neither of those will really play very well with a good, strong investor. You know, maybe your friends and family will figure that out. We'll go with that. But if you're trying to get someone else, it's probably going to be a little bit of a, it's going to lose some credibility there if you get what I mean. But so.
Well, great, Chris. So we've talked about just a handful of tools. Again, we're just going to repeat kind of what we've, as we wrap up here, kind of the three main areas we've covered. You know, Chris shared with us Striking the Steel, the story, to help us understand the leading in, how we can look at leading indicators that then will drive results as we look at building this cash flow projection. We looked at different metrics, direct versus indirect costs, et cetera. And then also the tools, some of the tools that are out there, such as QuickBooks and Excel, that we can use to put this the projections essentially, you know, almost like on paper, to put it out there and see really where we're going to need to at what point we might need to have cash. You know, that's one of the purposes of the cash flow projection, to say, hey, we put this out there. We're testing our model of what we think our business is looking like or needs to look like. When do we need cash? At what points in the year do we probably need cash? Maybe it's a credit line we got to put in place or go raise money before then from investors or get a loan by for that time period. Or we can say, okay, if we're not going to make it, where do we need to cut our expenses but still have a bona fide company and making revenue? And so that's this the kind of tool we need. And if you do use this tool, you're going to increase your chances of staying afloat through the hard times.
You know, one thought as you say that is, and I think you guys still have it, whether you guys are using it or not, I don't know, but you know, there's templates we have where we can put in and say, okay, I get paid my accounts receivable in X days. I have to pay my accounts payable here. I need to order my product, you know, X, you know, a month before I sell it and things like that. And that can very easily automate the process of being able to go, oh, well, here's where my cash crunch is. Yeah. You know, I remember, you know, so I was in banking for 20 plus years. Mm-hmm. I had one time when I had a client come to me and he would said, in 9 months, I think I'm going to have a cash shortfall. I need to get prepared.
That's someone who is using a tool like this.
He created it on his own. Mm-hmm. Did it on his own. And I'm sitting there like, oh my gosh, this is the first person in 20 years who has come and said, I see where it is. Now, I'm sure others, you know, did it and had it, but this was the first one who actually said that he had done it 9 months out. You know, usually they're using more guidelines. It's like, oh, we're growing. Can we get a line of credit? You know, and they know that if they get it, they'll use it. But, you know, he actually had projected out what his cash flow was going to be based on what he could anticipate. And he knew that he was going to have a little bit of a crunch. And believe me, when I went to my people and said, hey, in 9 months, he sees this need, they looked at me like, oh, okay, we can trust him.
Yeah.
It was total different credibility than what I would often have to deal with. You know, and I don't know if we want to, this could be put back in earlier in the thing, but, you know, one of the other things that often trips people up is keep getting their prime cost out of whack. You really want to make sure that you keep your prime cost down, keeping the overhead
down. And when you're saying prime cost, let's just make sure for your listeners what you're talking about, your top category cost. Like maybe labor is your top primary cost. For example, I worked years ago at Convergys Corporation, and the top cost was always, you know, the people who are on the phones, you know, they're the labor. Okay. You know, it's like, you know, what are 70-80% of total costs? Like if you just manage that, you manage most of it. So that's your prime cost in restaurants. It might be food
and labor,
or labor, or both, right?
Yeah.
Or
your lease. So yeah. The definition in the restaurant industry is prime cost or food and labor.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and if you're above 55%, you're in deep trouble.
Yeah.
Okay. Above what percent?
55 in the restaurant industry.
With those two combined?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. The exception would be, you know, kind of the high volume places like the McDonald's or whatever.
Okay.
I remember once going, my daughter went to UCLA. All these restaurants are down near the campus, and I'm looking during the day at the prices. It's like, how do they sell it for this cheap? And at night I drove by and there's 300 people in line. And it's like, no wonder why they could sell it that cheap.
Volume.
It's a volume business.
Wow. Yep.
Okay. So yeah. So the prime costs, you know, I remember one guy, he was doing cream sauces, you know, and most of his competition was buying like by 5 gallons. Well, he finally figured out, no, if I buy a tanker, 5,000 gallons, my cost is like 1/10.
Wow.
Mm. Now, there's some funny stories about how he had, when he tested it with a half load, he essentially got whipped cream.
But. Well, great. Okay. So prime cost, we got, so that's a very important kind of ending to this is making sure as you're putting together these projections, what are your major cost categories? And once you know those, then how do you manage those and maybe keep those, you know, there's different strategies to buy in bulk in some cases because you're going through it, get better deals that way, keep that low. And there's other ways to manage whatever your industry is. There's ways to manage that, but there also may be some very creative ways, and that's, to innovate within your space to make those costs go down even more. So, again, thanks for being here, Chris. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Chris. I learned a ton from this. This is great.
I always do talking with Chris. Same for me. I learned tons. Book recommendation this time around, Traction by Gabriel Weinberg.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great book. I think you read it. Read it a couple years ago.
Yeah. Great stories of... So he goes through every different type of channel for marketing. So billboards, TV, online. And he provides stories and examples of people who leveraged it at the appropriate time. And one of the key things that he brings out there is, hey, what worked last month may not work next month. So be prepared to keep changing and evolving. You know, and you know, it's interesting around here, you know, we see some of these billboards for some of these online companies, and it has a difference and it makes an impact, and obviously it's giving them the return. You go back a few years ago and people would say, oh no, an online business does not use a billboard.
That's true. So things change, and what's working today, to your point, you may actually hone in on it, and you it's okay to double down if something that's working, and when it's not working, then you do transition to another traction channel. So great insight there. All right, so we're also going to give a shout out to, we usually do this for an SBDC client or small business, but we're going to give a shout out to the Entrepreneur Academy. The Entrepreneur Academy is an online platform and curriculum produced by the Utah SBDC. So go to utahsbdc.org, click on the main the menu item listed as Entrepreneur Academy, and then sign up. And there's no cost to you. It is simply just a great resource for business owners just starting out or who are already established. So go ahead and sign up Entrepreneur Academy on the UtahSBDC.org website. And again, a shout out, like we always do, to The Mill. The Mill is located at the Salt Lake Community College Miller campus in Sandy, Utah. The Mill is also the home of the podcast room that we're in. That's a great little facility here. And if you're looking for co-working space, The Mill is one of the most cost-effective places in the Salt Lake Valley. It's the original co-working space in the Valley. Opened up about 15 years ago. And also a shout out to the Utah SBDC Network for providing the space and the freedom for us to do a podcast such as this. And we're just going to go ahead and end with our favorite line.
Tagline, yeah.
Here we go.
There you go.
The more you know, the more you grow.
Thanks, guys. We'll see you,
Take care, everybody.
The Utah SBDC is funded in part through a cooperative agreement with the U.S. Small Business Administration.